Hey everyone, and welcome back. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Awesome. Today we're tackling King Solomon, but not the usual Sunday school stuff.
Right.
We're going full-on archaeology mode. Think, like, what can actual discoveries tell us about this legendary king?
Yeah, using the real world to see if it matches up with the Bible.
It's like a detective story.
Totally. And to guide us, we've got Dr. Jeffrey Hudgens' lecture on biblical archaeology.
Specifically session 17.
Which is all about Solomon. Perfect.
But before we get to Solomon himself, we need some context, right? Like setting the stage.
Absolutely. Dr. Hudgens starts with this this really cool artifact, the Gezer calendar.
Gezer calendar.
It's this small stone tablet probably used for, you know, teaching kids.
Ah, interesting.
Just listing harvest dates. Mm-hmm. Like an ancient school exercise, maybe. But here's where it gets really cool. It's a palimpsest.
A palimpsest. Fancy word.
Just means there are older inscriptions.
I love it.
Visible underneath the calendar itself.
So like layers of history.
Exactly. On this one piece of stone. It's amazing.
Wow. That is cool. So, okay, so we've got this layered history. But to really get how the Bible portrays Solomon, we need to talk about the Deuteronomistic history.
Right. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, all that.
Yeah, like some of the most famous stories. But there's more to it than just the stories themselves, right?
Absolutely. Dr. Hudin emphasizes that it's theological history, meaning it's focused on the relationship between God and the Israelites.
So it's not just like a dry retelling of events. There's a message there.
Exactly. The authors had a point to make. They, you know, selected and shaped the historical details to convey that message.
Okay, so the Deuteronomistic history giving us this theological lens. But get this, the Book of Kings itself, it was based on even older documents, the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel and Judah, except we don't have them anymore. They're lost.
Lost to us.
Oh, man. Like, what? I wouldn't give to see those, but at least we have kings, and especially when we consider the idea of cumulative retribution.
Ah, yes. Key idea in Kings.
That consequences of your actions, especially disobeying God, can, like, build up over time.
Exactly. It affects future generations.
Yeah.
It's not just immediate cause and effect. There's this ripple effect throughout history.
Right. Like, choices made by one generation impacting everyone who comes after them. Powerful stuff.
Powerful stuff.
Okay, so we've got our context. Now let's go to the heart of Solomon's kingdom, Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
Such an iconic city, even today. But how did it look back then?
Well, Dr. Hudin is very clear. It wasn't just a city on a hill. It was a city of hills and valleys.
Ah, okay. So the topography matters.
It really does. You've got the Mount of Olives.
Right.
The Hill of Offense. The Kidron Valley. Names that just, like, evoke the history, you know?
Yeah, I can picture it. But did Jerusalem always include all those areas?
Not at all. It grew over time.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest settlement that was on the Eastern Hill, including the city of David.
Ah, the city of David, with all those incredible archaeological finds.
Exactly. Then, under Solomon, they incorporated Mount Moriah, also known as the Temple Mount.
Right, the Temple Mount.
And even later, they added the Western Hill.
Oh, wow. So the city was expanding over time.
It was, growing like a living thing, almost.
That's fascinating. Now, what about the walls we see today? Do those encompass all of this?
Good question. Those current walls, the ones built in the 16th century,
yeah,
they actually leave out the southern portions of both the eastern and western hills.
Really? So there could be undiscovered stuff out there.
Oh, absolutely. Just waiting to be found. Imagine the possibilities.
Talk about a potential deep dive.
No. Yeah.
Okay, now speaking of discoveries, Dr. Hudin also talks about Solomon's royal gardens.
Yes. Imagine these lush terraces on the slopes of the Kidron Valley.
Okay, so not just barren landscape, they had greenery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Probably irrigated by the Gihon Spring.
Wow, a real oasis then. That must have taken some serious engineering, though.
It would have been a major feat, a symbol of Solomon's power.
Right. It's like he was saying, look what I can do.
And Dr. Hudin even suggests that these gardens might reflect the biblical King's Valley.
King's Valley, okay.
A place of potentially ancient rituals.
Ah.
Maybe even a meeting between Abraham and Melchizedek. Way back.
Wow. So it's like layers of meaning, too.
Yeah, exactly. Just like those inscriptions on the Gezer calendar.
Okay. I love how everything connects.
It does.
Now, beyond the physical landscape, let's get into Solomon's empire itself.
Okay.
How did Solomon, as a ruler, stack up against his dad? King David, the warrior king, you know?
Well, while David focused on expanding through warfare, Solomon's reign. more about economic prosperity, strategic alliances.
So less about brute force, more about being savvy.
Exactly. He understood the power of trade, international relations.
Okay, smart. To manage this vast kingdom, how did he do it?
He divided it into 12 administrative districts, roughly aligning with the traditional tribal territories.
So he's working within existing systems. Smart move. But I bet not everyone loved paying taxes for all of this.
You're right. Dr. Hewden mentions complaints. Heavy taxation was definitely a thing.
But those taxes did help Solomon leave his mark, archaeologically speaking, right?
Yes, especially through his use of ashlar masonry.
Ashlar masonry? I'm not familiar.
It's a building technique using these finely carved stones fitted together without mortar.
Oh, interesting.
We see examples of it at Samaria, Megiddo, Heshbon.
So, like, if archaeologists see that, it's a Solomon clue.
It's a pretty good indicator. Points to his reign.
Okay, cool. Now, beyond administration and buildings, Solomon was also famous for his wives.
Oh, yes.
Hundreds. I can't even imagine. But these weren't just romantic relationships, right? Dr. Hewden says.
Mostly political marriages. To secure treaties, maintain peace.
Strategic alliances. Got it. And one of the most prominent wives was?
The daughter of the pharaoh.
Of course.
Yeah.
Talk about a powerful connection. And speaking of pharaoh's daughter, there's this monumental tomb in Jerusalem.
Right, the tomb of the pharaoh's daughter.
Yeah, and it's got architectural features hinting at Egyptian influence.
Potentially linking it to Solomon's era.
It's amazing how these ancient structures can offer clues about the people who live there.
It is. And sometimes we even get these smaller pieces, like ostraca. Pottery shards with writing on them.
Oh, right, little snippets of daily life. What do those tell us about Solomon?
Well, one from his reign actually seems to mention cheap wine.
Complaints about wine quality, even back then.
Apparently so. Maybe it was for Solomon's troops or something. Who knows?
It's just fun to imagine, you know, those little details.
It is. Now, of course, you can't talk Solomon without talking the temple.
Yes. The temple in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. One of the most important structures in Jewish history, described in detail in the Bible. But the big question is, did archaeologists actually find it?
Well, no physical remains have been conclusively identified.
Okay. So how do we even approach this?
Well, archaeologists get creative.
Mm.
They use those biblical descriptions and they compare them to other temples from that same time period.
So it's like detective work again.
Exactly. And one site that's a fascinating comparison is Ein Dara.
Ein Dara. Where's that?
It's in Syria. Features a massive temple dating back to the 9th century BC.
Okay.
With a strikingly similar floor plan to the temple described in the Bible. Both had an entrance area, a main hall, and an inner sanctum.
So the layout is the same, flow of movement.
Precisely. But even cooler, Ein Dara helps us visualize some of the decorations Solomon's temple might have had. For example, Ein Dara has these carved cherub figures.
The winged creatures.
That's them. Much like those described guarding the Ark of the Covenant. And remember how the Bible mentions lattice as decoration, but no one really knew what that meant.
Right. Vague description.
Well, Ein Dara has carved stone lattice work.
So we're literally getting a visual example from another ancient temple. That's so cool. It's like archaeology is filling in the blanks of the text.
Exactly. And there's another site, too, that offers these parallels. Tel Tainat.
Tel Tainat. Okay. New location.
It's in Turkey. Has a royal palace complex with a smaller temple next to it, also dating back to the 9th century BC.
So there seems to be this, like, common architectural style for temples back then.
It appears so. Shared traditions across the ancient Near East.
Right. Makes sense. But even with all this, the exact location of Solomon's temple on the Temple Mount itself is still debated.
It is.
The Temple Mount, such a contested site. How do archaeologists even approach that?
Carefully. Dr. Hewden points to the work of Lien Rittmeyer.
Okay.
An architect who's dedicated his life to studying the Temple Mount. He focuses on the exposed bedrock.
The bedrock itself.
Within the Dome of the Rock. He's looking for clues there.
Wow. So he's going deep. Literally, what's he found?
He claims to have found foundation cuts that align with the dimensions of the Holy of Holies.
No way.
And get this, he also found a rectangular depression that perfectly matches the size of the Ark of the Covenant.
Wait, so he thinks he's found the spot where the Ark of the Covenant sat? The chest with the Ten Commandments, you know?
That's what he's suggesting.
That's incredible. If true, of course.
Of course. Now, this is controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Hewden presents Rittmeyer's findings as a very compelling possibility.
Right.
He brings in historical accounts, rabbinical traditions, and the archaeological observations, all of it.
So he's not just making this up. He's got a whole argument.
He does. Now, underneath all of this, there's this cave under the Dome of the Rock called the Well of the Souls.
Well of the Souls.
What's he name?
It is a bit mysterious. One archaeologist, Riv Kagonin, has this controversial theory that it might be a Bronze Age tomb.
A tomb? Before the temple.
Potentially belonging to a powerful Jebusite family. So before Solomon's time.
Whoa, that adds another layer of history. It's like peeling back an onion. Each layer reveals something new.
And it's important to remember those layers when we talk about Solomon's building projects outside Jerusalem.
Okay, so beyond Jerusalem now, where do we start? Dr. Hewden focuses on 1 Kings 9. It's like a blueprint for Solomon's construction projects. One key detail is the mention of Gezer.
Gezer, okay.
A city destroyed by the pharaoh.
Ah, right.
And then given as a wedding gift to Solomon's wife.
The pharaoh's daughter. So this political marriage leads to Solomon rebuilding Gezer.
Exactly. And fortifying it. And archaeologists actually found evidence of this.
No way, really?
Excavations show a major destruction layer followed by rebuilding, perfectly matching the biblical account.
Wow. So it's like the Bible and archaeology are high-fiving there. What other cities did Solomon fortify?
The text mentions Hazor, Megiddo, and Lower Beth Horon.
Okay. And were these strategic spots?
Oh, absolutely. Hazor guarded the north. Megiddo controlled the Jezreel Valley.
Right. Important valley.
And Gezer, that protected the approaches to Jerusalem.
So he's creating this defensive network, like a web around his kingdom.
Exactly. And here's an incredible detail. Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. They all have these six-chambered gates.
Six-chambered gates? Why is that a big deal?
They're remarkably similar in design and dimensions, suggesting a single architect was behind all three.
Wow. So that's not just coincidence. That's intentional.
It really speaks to a high level of planning control on Solomon's part.
Like having the same IKEA furniture in three different cities. Okay. Now, alongside these gates, archaeologists found some structures.
Yes.
But there's debate about what they were.
Right. Some think they were storehouses.
Makes sense.
For grain, oil, wine, collected as taxes, you know. Keep those royal coffers full.
Exactly. But others say
they think stables. For Solomon's army, housing horses and chariots.
Maybe they serve both purposes at different times. Who knows? Yeah. Either way, it shows Solomon's like consolidating power through these projects.
It does. The biblical passage also mentions Tadmor in the desert, which might be Palmyra in Syria, but more likely Tamar in the Arava Valley.
Okay.
Excavations there uncovered a fortified complex, 10th century BC, right in line with Solomon.
So he was thinking big, expanding into those desert regions too.
It seems so. Now, even further south, there's this cluster of fortified settlements.
Settlements where?
In the Negev Highlands.
In the Negev. That's rough terrain. What were those settlements all about?
That's the million-dollar question. Were they part of Solomon's kingdom or someone else's? Were they agricultural, trying to make the desert bloom, or were they strategic, guarding his southern border?
So many possibilities. It's like those settlements are missing puzzle pieces, and we're still figuring out where they fit.
Exactly. They highlight the debates about Solomon's influence and how he interacted with different groups.
Right. Makes sense. Boundaries weren't always so clear-cut back then. Speaking of boundaries, let's talk about Solomon's relationship with Hiram.
King of Tyre.
Yeah, Hiram. Yeah. He was key in building the temple, right?
He was. He provided cedar wood and skilled craftsmen for the construction.
So a crucial partnership.
It was. And in return, Solomon gave him 20 towns in the Galilee region called the Land of Kabul.
Ah, so like a kingly trade agreement, land for services. Did they find any of those towns?
Well, one possibility is Rosh Zayit. There's a 10th century BC fortress there.
Okay. Could be a link to their agreement then. Case closed.
Not so fast. There's a debate over who actually built the fortress. Was it Solomon as part of the deal? Or was it Hiram himself, establishing a Phoenician presence?
Another mystery. It's like a historical game of Clue, figuring out who did what, where, and why.
And sometimes those answers remain elusive.
That's what makes it fun. It's not just about the answers, but the process of uncovering them.
You got it.
All right. So far, we've covered a lot of ground, from Jerusalem to the Negev Highlands. It's been fascinating to see how the archaeological evidence lines up with the biblical accounts, but I have a feeling things are about to get even more interesting.
Oh, you have no idea. Stay tuned for part two of our deep dive,
where we'll explore some of the more controversial aspects of Solomon's reign.
From his maritime ventures.
To his alleged supernatural connections. Can't wait to hear about that. See you in part two.
See you then.
Welcome back to our deep dive into King Solomon. Last time we were like tracing his footsteps through these archaeological sites. It was amazing to see those discoveries actually matching up with what the Bible says. But I have a feeling things are about to get even more interesting.
You're right. As we dig deeper, we'll see that archaeology doesn't always confirm the Bible so neatly. Sometimes it challenges those traditional interpretations, raises new questions.
That's what I love about this. It's not just accepting what we've been told. It's about using the evidence, right, to figure out the past.
Exactly. It adds like layers of complexity to the story.
Right. It's not always black and white.
Not at all. For instance, remember those structures we talked about?
Mm-hmm.
Found in Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer?
Mm-hmm.
That debate, whether they were storehouses or stables, that highlights this challenge perfectly.
It shows us that, like, interpreting these archaeological remains, it's not always easy.
It's not. There's not always one right answer.
And sometimes discoveries can totally shake things up.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Well of the Souls underneath the Temple Mount. That possibility that it was a tomb before Solomon built his temple, that really throws a wrench in things.
It makes you question everything. Like, whoa, what else have we gotten wrong?
It's like a plot twist in a history book.
Speaking of mysteries, Solomon's maritime ventures. Ophir and Tarshish.
Oh, those names. It's like pure adventure.
They just scream adventure.
But no one knows their exact locations, which just makes it even more intriguing.
It's a real-life treasure hunt. Scholars are still trying to pinpoint these destinations, looking at ancient texts, maps, archaeological clues, all of it.
And while we may never know for sure, I think the search itself tells us something important about Solomon's reign.
What's that?
It tells us that he wasn't just some isolated king. His maritime ventures, they were part of this huge network, you know,
okay.
of trade and cultural exchange, spanning continents.
You're right. It's like ancient globalization.
Exactly. Goods, technologies, ideas, all flowing back and forth. And that must have left a mark on Solomon's kingdom.
It would have. Their material culture, their beliefs, their practices, all influenced by these exchanges.
Right. It makes you wonder, how much of what we think of as Israelite culture actually came from somewhere else?
Cultural identity was always fluid, especially back then, with so much interaction between different groups.
Okay, so Dr. Hudon takes us on this tour of sites connected to Solomon's maritime adventures. He starts with Etzion Geber, the legendary port city.
Ah, Etzion Geber. The launch pad for Solomon's fleets. Can you imagine the hustle and bustle of that ancient port?
I'm trying to. The ships, the goods, the smells.
Yeah.
But even the location is debated, right?
It is. The two main contenders are Coral Island and Pharaoh's Island.
Okay.
Both strategically located in the Gulf of Aqaba, giving access to those important trade routes.
So it's like two puzzle pieces that might fit the same spot.
Exactly. We need more clues.
Now, moving inland, we have Kerbet and Nahas.
Ah, yes. Kerbet and Nahas. Dr. Hugan believes this was the site of Solomon's copper mines.
And copper was essential back then, right?
Oh, absolutely. For tools, weapons, even currency. Control over copper mines meant wealth and power.
So this was Solomon's Fort Knox, in a way.
You could say that?
I can only imagine what it took to mine copper on that scale. The manpower.
It was a sophisticated operation, showing us what Solomon's kingdom was capable of.
But processing copper takes more than manpower, right? What about that massive beekeeping operation at Tel Rikof?
Ah, yes, that's where the beeswax came in.
Right, the beeswax. Wasn't that used for something?
Essential for making the molds used in copper casting.
It all connects. So Solomon wasn't just extracting copper. He was controlling the whole process.
From the mines to the beehives. A true businessman.
Okay, so now we've got mines, we've got bees. What about Tel El Khalifa? Could that be the biblical islet?
That's what Dr. Hudon proposes. And if he's right, it would be a key piece of Solomon's maritime network.
I can just picture those ships sailing between Etzion Geber, Eilat, points further south, bringing back all those exotic goods.
Really captures the imagination. Now, as we move even further south, we get to those mysterious fortified settlements.
It's in the Negev Highlands, right?
Yes, in that really harsh environment.
It's hard to imagine what life was like there.
That's part of what makes them so fascinating, though. Were they part of Solomon's kingdom, pushing the boundaries of his control? Or were these settlements belonging to someone else? Rivals, even.
It's like a choose-your-own-adventure for archaeologists. So many possibilities.
And the evidence is still being debated. But one thing's for sure. Those settlements remind us that the ancient world was complex. Shifting boundaries, competing interests.
Not so different from today, really. Okay, last stop on our Solomon's Building Project tour, Rosh Hazayit in the Galilee.
Ah, Rosh Hazayit. That fortress. potentially linked to the land of Kabul.
The land that Solomon gave to Hiram as payment, right?
Yes, for his help with the temple. But there's that mystery again.
Oh, of course.
Who actually built it? Was it Solomon as part of the deal? Or Hiram establishing a Phoenician presence?
It's like we need a time machine to go back and see for ourselves.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would. But even without all the answers, we've learned a lot about Solomon's building project.
We have. We've seen his strategic thinking, his organizational skill.
All right. Those six-chambered gates, they weren't just about defense. It was a statement.
Exactly. And the temple, more than just a place of worship, a symbol of his piety, his connection to the divine.
It's like he was trying to create this kingdom that could rival the big ones, Egypt, Assyria.
And in a way, he did succeed. The Bible describes his reign as a golden age, a time of peace and prosperity.
But of course, we know it wasn't all sunshine and roses, right?
Right.
The archaeological evidence shows a more nuanced picture. Those complaints about taxes, forced labor.
They remind us that there were costs associated with this golden age.
And that his kingdom split apart after his death. Maybe those burdens were just too heavy.
It's a classic tale of ambition and its consequences.
But even with those complexities, Solomon's reign was a turning point in the ancient Near East.
Absolutely. He left a lasting legacy, one that still fascinates us today.
Speaking of fascinating, let's move on to one of the most intriguing parts of Solomon's legacy, his supposed supernatural connections.
Ah, yes. This is where things get really mysterious.
Okay, spill the tea. What kind of supernatural abilities are we talking about?
Well, there are stories of him summoning demons.
Demons. To do what?
To help build the temple.
Demons as construction workers. Now, that's a mental image.
It might sound strange to us, but back then, people believed supernatural beings could be used for human projects.
So it's like ancient technology. Tapping into the unseen world.
Exactly. And for Solomon, commanding demons showed his divine favor, his special status as a ruler.
Like he was above ordinary mortals, with powers most people couldn't even comprehend.
And beyond the demons, the Bible hints at Solomon's knowledge of magic, divination. He's portrayed as someone who could see the future, unravel the secrets of the universe.
Ah, the classic image of the wise king as a mystic, a magician.
Right. It makes you wonder, where did those stories come from?
Yeah, where did they come from?
Remember those lost chronicles of the kings? What if we had those? They might have more details about Solomon's magical practices.
It's like a lost archive full of secrets. The historian in me is dying to know. Okay, but back to reality. Is there any archaeological evidence for all this? Like, can they dig up a demon?
Huh. No, it's not that straightforward.
Right.
But we can look for clues in the material culture. Amulets were common back then. Magical objects.
Oh, right. Like those little charms for protection. Good luck.
Exactly. It's hard to link specific ones to Solomon's time, but they show us that magic was a big deal back then.
For them, the supernatural wasn't separate. It was part of their world.
Precisely. We can also look at the architecture, the iconography of his building projects.
Iconography.
The symbols, the images used in decoration. It's like the visual language of the past.
Okay, so like hidden messages in the art and architecture.
Right. The temple is a good example.
Yeah.
It was designed as more than just a building. It was a microcosm of the cosmos, a sacred space where heaven and earth met.
Right. Full of symbolism, like the cherubim, those winged creatures.
Their presence suggests a belief in supernatural beings, their role in connecting humans to the divine.
And the Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber housing the Ark of the Covenant, believed to contain the presence of God.
The temple was full of supernatural significance, a place where the boundaries between the material and immaterial blurred.
It's almost like Solomon was trying to create a portal to the divine, a physical representation of his connection to the supernatural.
Fascinating interpretation. And beyond the temple, some scholars believe that certain geometric patterns found in Solomonic architecture might be evidence of magical beliefs.
Geometric patterns? Wait, what? How is that magic?
Well, in some ancient cultures, specific shapes and patterns were believed to have supernatural properties.
So by incorporating them into his buildings, Solomon was harnessing that power, like magic architecture.
It's a theory, but it shows us that even seemingly simple design choices can have deeper meaning.
Don't underestimate ancient architecture.
Exactly. But we have to acknowledge the challenges of studying someone like Solomon. He lived so long ago.
We're dealing with limited evidence.
Right. Fragmented sources. And trying to see the past through our modern lens.
It's like trying to solve a puzzle with half the pieces missing and no picture on the box.
Huh. Great analogy. And because of that, we need to be cautious. Approach this with a bit of skepticism, a bit of humility.
Right. We don't have all the answers.
We don't. But that's okay. It's a journey of exploration, a conversation with the past that keeps evolving.
I love that. Okay. To understand Solomon's reign better, we need to zoom out. Right.
Yes.
Look at the bigger picture, the geopolitical landscape of his time.
Exactly. See how he fits into the world around him.
So who are the major players on the world stage when Solomon was king?
Well, to the south, you had Egypt, still a force to be reckoned with, even though their power had diminished somewhat.
But not to be messed with, I'm guessing.
Definitely not. And Solomon knew that. His marriage to the Pharaoh's daughter, that was a strategic move. To secure peace, access to resources, trade networks.
Smart move, like an ancient royal power couple.
Exactly. It also provided a buffer against potential Egyptian aggression.
Okay, so south, we've got Egypt. What about north and east?
To the north, the Phoenician city-states, especially Tyre, were major maritime powers.
Right, controlling the Mediterranean trade routes. And we talked about Solomon's relationship with Hiram, king of Tyre.
Right, they needed each other. Solomon needed Hiram's expertise in shipbuilding, seafaring. Hiram benefited from Solomon's resources, markets.
A classic win-win. Shows how alliances, trade could really drive things back then.
Absolutely. Now, further east, things were more volatile.
Uh-oh. Why?
The Assyrian Empire was on the rise, expanding its territory through military conquest.
The Assyrians, weren't they known for being a bit aggressive?
Yeah. They had a reputation for brutality and efficiency. They posed a threat to everyone in the region, including Solomon.
So even if they weren't right next door, Solomon had to keep an eye on them.
Exactly. Like a game of chess trying to anticipate their moves.
Makes sense. A wise king can't ignore potential threats.
Right. And beyond these big powers, Solomon also had to deal with smaller kingdoms, tribal groups, right on his borders.
Those can be tricky, too. Sometimes they're friends, sometimes enemies, always changing.
Exactly. Solomon seems to have used a mix of diplomacy, alliances, and sometimes force to manage them.
Like any good leader, adapting to the situation. But how do we know all this about the geopolitical scene? Is it just from the Bible?
The Bible gives us some clues. But we have to be careful. It's written from a certain perspective.
Right. Not exactly an unbiased source. What else do we have?
Well, archaeology. Excavations at Hazor, Megiddo, Gezer. They've shown layers of destruction dating back to the late Bronze Age, early Iron Age.
Ah, so these suggest periods of conflict.
Exactly. Possibly linked to Egyptian campaigns or conflicts between local kingdoms. It gives us this tangible record of what was going on.
So we can compare that to the biblical account, see where they line up, where they differ.
Right. And we also have inscriptions from other kingdoms, Egypt, Assyria, mentioning events, rulers in the Levant.
So we're getting an outsider's perspective on Solomon's kingdom.
Exactly. They help us understand the broader context.
It's all about connecting the dots. Okay, now let's zoom back in and talk about Solomon's kingdom itself, the social and economic structures.
Right. From international relations to the inner workings of Solomon's society.
So who are the key players? How did the system work?
Well, at the very top, you had Saruman, the king, absolute power.
The top dog. But he couldn't run everything himself, right?
Definitely not. He had officials, priests, military leaders, all helping him.
Like an ancient cabinet.
Exactly. And the Bible even mentions specific roles. The chief of staff, the commander of the army, showing a clear hierarchy.
So there was a system in place.
There was.
Okay, so that's the elite. What about everyone else?
Below them, you had the free citizens. Farmers, artisans, merchants. The backbone of society.
They kept things running.
They did. They produced goods, paid taxes, served in the army. Their lives were directly impacted by Solomon's policies.
But not everyone was a free citizen.
Unfortunately, no. Slavery was common in the ancient world.
And Solomon's kingdom was no exception.
It was not. The Bible even mentions forced labor for his building projects.
Right. We can't ignore that part of his reign.
We can't. It reminds us that even during supposedly good times, there were still injustices.
Okay, now for the economic side. How did Solomon's kingdom generate wealth?
Well, we talked about those copper mines at Kirbit and Nahas. Those were a major source of income.
Right. Controlling valuable resources.
And his maritime ventures brought in exotic goods, luxury items that boosted the economy further.
Bringing in things from all over. It's like an ancient shopping spree.
Huh. And in addition to that, Solomon levied taxes.
Taxes. Gotta love them.
They're essential.
Yeah.
But the Bible suggests they were pretty heavy. Led to some grumbling.
Sounds familiar. So What was it like to be a regular person in Solomon's kingdom?
It's hard to say for sure. We don't have detailed records.
Right.
But we can make some guesses.
Okay, what do we think?
Well, the evidence suggests his reign was relatively peaceful.
That's a big plus in the ancient world.
Huge plus.
Yeah.
That would have allowed for economic growth, social development.
People could actually focus on their lives, not just surviving war.
Exactly. But even then, there were inequalities. Some people were exploited.
So some good, some bad. Just like any society.
Right. But there's also evidence of advancement during his reign.
Oh, like what?
We've already talked about the fancy pottery.
Yeah.
And his building projects, although demanding, they created jobs, led to technological innovation. His maritime ventures brought in new goods, new ideas.
So it was a time of great change, progress, but also challenges.
Exactly. We need to avoid those simple stories. Solomon's reign wasn't all good. It wasn't all bad. It was complex.
It was life.
It was life. And by looking at the evidence, considering different perspectives, we get a clearer picture of this period.
Well, we've covered a lot in this episode, from Solomon's building projects to those maritime ventures and even his possible supernatural connections.
It's been a whirlwind.
And next time, we'll wrap up our deep dive by exploring Solomon's legacy, the impact he had.
We'll also talk about some of those enduring mysteries and how archaeology might help us unlock those secrets in the future.
Sounds like there's still much to uncover. See you next time for the final part of our King Solomon deep dive. Welcome back, everyone. We've been on this amazing journey exploring the world of King Solomon.
It's been quite the deep dive, from those massive building projects to the mysteries surrounding his supernatural connections. It's incredible how much we can learn from, you know, digging into the past.
It really makes you think, like, history isn't just some boring subject in a textbook.
Right.
It's full of real people living real lives, facing challenges, just like we do today, just in a totally different setting.
Exactly. And someone like Solomon, he's both a historical figure and a legendary one. His story's been told for centuries, woven into all these traditions and narratives. But archaeology can help us see, like, the actual person, you know?
Right, to sort through all the layers, the myths, and get to the truth.
Precisely. Like peeling back an onion, each layer revealing something new.
And the coolest thing is, the digging never really stops. Every new excavation, every artifact, it can change how we understand Solomon.
Oh, absolutely. There's still so much we don't know. That's what keeps archaeology so exciting.
Totally. So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's talk about Solomon's legacy. What kind of lasting impact did his reign have on the ancient Near East?
Well, he was ambitious. He really wanted to expand his kingdom's power and influence. We see that in everything. His military, his alliances, the economic growth, even those huge building projects.
He wanted to leave his mark. And, I mean, from what we've talked about, he did, at least while he was alive.
He did. But success often comes with a price. Remember all those complaints about heavy taxes, forced labor? Those things led to problems.
Right. And after he died, the kingdom actually split apart.
It did.
So, in a way, his ambition to be powerful might have led to his kingdom's downfall. It's kind of ironic.
It's a classic paradox of leadership, isn't it? The very things that bring success can also cause trouble down the road.
Yeah, it's like that saying, heavy is the head that wears the crown. Even the best rulers face tough choices, unintended consequences.
Absolutely. And Solomon's story shows us that history is never simple. It's full of different perspectives, different sides to every story.
So what can we learn from Solomon's legacy today, thousands of years later?
I think his story teaches us about power, about ambition, and the importance of balance.
Like finding that balance between progress and making sure it doesn't hurt people.
Exactly. Creating a society that works for everyone, not just the people at the top.
And that even the most powerful leaders, they're still human. They make mistakes. Their stories are never just good or bad.
Exactly. It's always more complicated than that. Okay, so we've covered a lot. The building projects, the seafaring, the wisdom, the supernatural stuff, even the geopolitics of the time. But are there still mysteries surrounding Solomon that we might, you know, solve someday?
Oh, I bet there are. Like, we still don't know where Ophir and Tarshish are, those legendary places.
Right. It's like something out of an adventure movie. What if we found more inscriptions from his reign? Or even, like, royal archives hidden in some tomb we haven't discovered yet.
I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
Right. Who knows what's out there waiting to be found? That's what makes archaeology so amazing.
It always keeps us guessing. It reminds us that history is always changing, evolving as we learn more.
Exactly. So next time you see an old artifact, a ruin, even just a pile of dirt, remember, there might be a whole story there.
Yeah.
Just waiting to be uncovered.
It could tell us about a lost city, a forgotten king, even just a normal person who lived thousands of years ago.
And who knows? Maybe one day you'll be the one making those discoveries.
Well, that's a wrap on our deep dive into King Solomon. I hope you've enjoyed this adventure with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And remember, history is more than just dates and names. It's about real people.
Their ambitions, their struggles, and the legacy they leave behind.
And through archaeology, we can connect with those people, bring their stories to life. The past is never truly lost if we know where to look.
So keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep digging deeper into the world of history. You never know what you might find.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. See you next time.